Hey, this is Adam Carolla telling you to listen to the Antique Auction Podcast with Martin Willis.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis, and welcome to the Antique Auction Podcast Show. We now have two different kinds of segments, the usual informative segment, such as the one you're about to hear, and segments involving upcoming auctions of interest, interviewing auctioneers and staff. You can always email us at auctionpodcast@me.com. We're always looking for suggestions and new ideas, and we look forward to reading the emails. Thank you, and enjoy the show today. Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis. We have a real special phone guest today. I'm going to tell you how I stumbled across the show that he podcasts. Phyllis and I were trying to figure out if there were other people doing podcasts on antiques and auctions, and on iTunes came across a show called Keep Antiquing, and listened to it, and it was great. And with us today is Frank Farmer Loomis. And hi, Frank, how you doing?
Hi, Martin. Thank you for your kind words about the show.
Sure, great. So you're in Cincinnati.
I am stuck in Cincinnati for the duration.
Yeah.
Now, I sound like I don't like Cincinnati. I adore Cincinnati.
It's a wonderful town. About 20 years ago, something like that, there was a National Auctioneers Convention in Cincinnati, and I loved that town.
It is great. And we got electricity since then, Martin.
Oh.
But you know how it is when New Yorkers come, do they have electricity here yet? Well, I'm glad you like Cincinnati. It has a great, antiques background, decorative arts, and everything like that. So
sure,
I'm excited because you're near an incredible city yourself.
San Francisco area.
Oh,
yes.
My God,
yeah.
The only thing about San Francisco that bugged me was that one of the things that the French do better than anything else is they mark their historic buildings. And I wish maybe they'd done better on that, but I wish that San Francisco would mark its buildings better.
Well, there are some marked buildings. There are historical markers on buildings with little stories on them. If you ever come into San Francisco, I'll walk you through. It's pretty interesting. That talks about running the fire hoses up the street past this building, stuff like that.
That would be great. I remember, Martin, that the James Flood Building had an incredible display in its lobby. And I loved how they explained it. That's on Market Street, if I'm not mistaken. And I love how they explain, how it survived the fire and the shell and everything. Yeah, I'd love that because I think San Francisco is an incredible city.
Yeah. So tell me about your, I've looked a little bit at your bio, you've written books, things like that, but your show, let's talk quickly about your show because people listen to my podcast may want to listen to yours.
Well, let's talk slowly about it. No, I'm just kidding you.
Yeah. So where do you find your show online to podcast it?
You can go to keepantiquing.org and it'll explain all the, how to get to the podcast, to the broadcast, archive shows and everything like that. Like you can, Martin, you'll be able to, you're recording me, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I was going to say you could listen. But no, you already could listen to your own interview. Yeah, you go to keepantiquing.org.
Yeah, and you're on public radio as well?
Yes, in two stations in Cincinnati, yes.
Well, I hope our listeners will take some time to listen because Frank runs a great show. And there's also, I really, really enjoyed the one you did on New Orleans.
Oh, well, it's funny you should bring that up. Thank you very much. I loved every second of that show. And I had never been to New Orleans before, and I always thought that San Francisco was the most European of United States cities. But, life is a series of learning adventures. Yeah. I mean, New Orleans, my God, it's a little bit of France, and I'm a Francophile. And we have other interviews for New Orleans, some of the historic houses And thank you for enjoying that show because it's very dear to me. I love New Orleans.
I was really happy to hear also that it's having a good comeback.
It is. It is. And I don't know what the people were like before, but they probably were just wonderful before because of Southern gentility and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's probably made them all even more, kinder to each other from the hell they went through.
Sure.
And one of the neat things was when I was down there if I can get this name right, it's the Museum of Southern Food and Beverage,
really?
Which is called the initials. Are you ready for this, Martin? SOFAP.
Yeah,
I met Mrs.
Initials.
Chase, who is the owner of the Dookie Chase restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and she had been on 60 Minutes. This lady is about 85 years old, and she reminded me of my grandmother, my wonderful grandmother. And she owns this restaurant. She was on 60 Minutes right after Katrina, and I had seen this. It was a thrill to meet her. And she kept telling me, quit lying and be glad you're alive and everything. And to meet her was just a real thrill, and I'm trying to get to interview her.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad you liked that show because I loved every second of doing it. And wasn't John Bullard of the New Orleans Museum of Art an incredible interviewee?
Yeah, that was funny when you kept saying, don't be so shy or something like that.
I think the New Orleans Museum of Art has to be one of the most visitor-friendly museums on the face of the earth.
Really?
And it's all a credit to him.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently in Pittsburgh, and I went to the Carnegie Museum of Art. I had to do a lecture outside of Pittsburgh. And that museum is incredibly visitor-friendly, too. And, Martin, you know how museums will have their European galleries and then their American galleries and everything?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They mixed it all up. The only ones they kept separate were the Oriental ones. And I thought that was just great because, all these paintings and furniture, they all swim together, whether they're from the U.S. of A., Canada, or France, or
mm-hmm.
Scandinavian countries or whatever. So
mm-hmm.
John
mm-hmm.
Bullard is the longest reigning executive of an art museum. I think he said he's been there 37 years.
Wow. And so let me just talk a little bit about you. And I always ask this of people in the business because there's always a story to it. How did you get interested in antiques to begin with?
Oh, do you really want that story?
Sure, why not?
I imagine how I got interested in the antiques was that it was destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds corny, but when I was growing up, I had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Aunt Panny, P-A-N-N-Y, and she was basically like an Auntie Mame. And Aunt Panny was divorced in the early 50s, which was a real scandal.
Taboo, yeah.
And she married a divorced man. Well, anyway, her husband had to pay child support, and my aunt made sure that child support was paid. Well, anyway, they didn't have any money. So she started, buying, back in those days, like the round oak dining room tables.
Oh, yeah. When everybody was, yes.
And so I went with her, and one thing led to another, and, I became totally hooked on antiques. And it's just so funny. I remember that she moved in the fall of, 1962 or something. I was like 3 years old, but I still can remember it. Ha ha. Anyway, the round oak dining room table, the claw feet, it was a beauty, and that was her pride and joy. And they were moving, and it's so funny that how things happen. And I remember the mover saying to her, lady, do you want that junk to go too? And I remember she was very provoked by that, quite justifiably.
Sure.
So that's basically how I got hooked on antiques.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great.
How did you get hooked on antiques?
Well, I started, lived in New England, and lived in a nice early home. And in the woods, I stumbled across a bottle dump. It kind of sounds funny, but I started digging bottles, and I actually, now this is back in the 60s, showed one of these unusual bottles to someone. He paid $40 back then for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, that was like enough money to carry me for a year, when you were a kid.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of interest in it, but my father stumbled into the auction business back in 1970. He always was into antiques, and so I'm a second generation.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So
we always had new furniture every 2 years.
Right, same here.
And my parents would buy, they bought the living room and dining room all together in one fell swoop. It was, so I'm still in therapy guilty about, you know, not having been brought up with antiques.
Well, the funny thing is we did too, but in a different way. What my father used to do is, and it was, I don't know of anyone that does this today, but he would fill the house with antiques, and then he'd have a party and sell the antiques right on the floor, right during the party. It
was, oh, your dad was a clever businessman. Whoa.
He really did. So I always come home to something different in the house.
It was, so you ended up some night sleeping on the floor?
Yeah, I'm in therapy too, so.
Yeah,
it's okay. So, this, another thing I always, when someone has a passion for antiques, I know they share this, and that is a lot of times when you see something, this is how I feel, and tell me if it's the same way with you. Whenever I'm, say, going to a house or something comes to me that's really extremely rare and beautiful, I get really, really excited about it. But it's never really the value that I get excited about, just the item. Do you feel that way?
Absolutely.
I
couldn't agree with you more. Years ago, a client told me that he could always, I was doing a big appraisal for him, and that was in the days before laptops. I took notes, you know, longhand, which you probably remember too. He said he always could tell when I liked something that I was appraising, and I said, well, why is that? He says, well, when you're writing down and describing it, your head would nod up and down. And then I said to him, well, you know, I'm not jealous of anything you have. And he looked at me very seriously. He said, well, you couldn't be an appraiser if you were.
That's right.
That was a pretty good remark, and true, too.
Yeah, yep. So you then, you had a shop. I had a shop for a while, too. And I couldn't stand just sitting there, but...
Amen, brother. I think I had mine on and off for 5 years, and then I've been appraising full-time since 1980.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when I listen to your show, you do mention auction. One of the things I really like about what you say when you're dealing with people is, and you say the same thing I do, and that is, this piece... you know, you may want to try on eBay or something like that. And then I hear a number of times auction is the way to go with this piece. And it's really true. If someone's going to fight for something, auction's a great way to go.
It really is, and I believe in it wholeheartedly. I think I always say to them, though, you know, I'd be a fibber if I didn't tell you you were taking a chance.
Sure, yeah.
But especially these days, but I always like to tell them that when you have one item, you're taking more of a chance.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you agree with me that when you have 10.
Absolutely, because something will take off in that 10 items.
And one will go for less, but the bottom line is, how much is that check for?
That's right. One thing will make up for another.
Right.
Yeah. You know, right now, the movement I've seen in the last couple of years in auctions, and because that's mostly what I focus on is auctions, but it seems to me that there's not as much dealer participation in auctions. Thus, the prices are kind of more or less guided between the auction hall and the bidding public. And so your prices, as an appraiser, it's very difficult. And let me just tell you a quick example. I do contract work for an auction house in Northern California, Kalar's in Oakland. And we had a Meissen figurine, a nice, excuse me, early 19th century Meissen figure. A real beauty. And I put it at $800 to $1,200.
Right.
And nobody bid.
Uh-huh.
So it was an estate. They just wanted to sell it. We dropped it down to $400 to $600 in the next sale, and it went for $3,750.
Right.
And so the prices are just sporadic.
Right. Well, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. First of all, let me just say something. I love Oakland.
Oh, you do?
I love that three-block area where they restore. Don't they call it out there stick architecture?
Yes, I've heard that. Yes, right.
And I always call it East Lake architecture. But, oh, my God, that three-block strip took my breath away, how beautiful that is. No, you're absolutely right, because somebody was I love to talk to callers and stuff, and I always try to rope them into the studio because it's more fun to look them right in the eye and everything, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And this woman had Yardbell figurines, and she said to me, what do you think? And I wasn't real very high figures for her, but she said, well, what do you think about eBay? And I said to her, I think eBay would be fantastic for this because it is a Yardbell figurine. Nobody needs to be bent out of shape. Is it a fake or whatever?
Right.
You can do that with security. And I told her, if I were you, though, starting bid on it. I would put no reserve on it because it's going to be just like what you said. And I said, just, you know, let them get into a match that involves a nasty liquid. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, Martin, but I won't say what it is. And, you know, people will get in a bidding war about this. And she pulled out her eBay record on something. She says, you're exactly right. She had, like, I think there were, like, 10 identical statues by Yargo, these Spanish statues,
right.
And I forget what the title was. Only one of them sold, and it was the one that had no minimum bid on it or no whatever. Mm-hmm. They had 25 bids on that. The other 9 never even had a bid on them.
That's right. You know, you get people involved in bidding, and the way you do not get people involved in bidding in an auction is to have too high of an estimate.
Right.
So once people start, it's an bidding is an emotional thing. People don't realize that. Do not bid. You know, it's an emotional thing. And once you get involved, you just, it's almost like gambling. You just say, well, that one, I'm going to hit it one more time and that's it. And then, and then you say it again a few more times and then you're up about 15-20% higher than you thought you'd be. But, you know, it's a, you feel like it's a shame to lose it once you're involved.
I also think what you were saying about the auctions and stuff, I think more and more private people are buying them because of the internet and everything.
Right.
And they've sort of almost become retail now.
And a thing like you just said earlier, say Yadro or a Hummel or anything like that, it's a cut and dry thing. It's not like there's a lot to explain about it, you know.
Correct.
You know, the only thing you need to explain is condition. You know,
correct.
If there's condition issues.
Right.
So it's not like something where someone has to do research and they may not trust what you're selling.
Right, correct.
You know, I'll just tell you a quick story about a bronze. I had a really nice Art Nouveau bronze, and I have I have a lot of feedback on eBay since 98. And so I put this bronze on eBay, and I couldn't get $500 for it, and it was a beauty, and it was a French, I can't think of the maker right now, the sculptor. So then I put it in auction, and it brought $2,750, so, and what it should have brought. So I talked to someone that does, all he does is eBay, and I talked to him, and I said, what is the deal with that? And he says, it doesn't matter that you have 100% positive feedback. There's just so many recast bronzes that nobody wants to trust that it's real.
Right. No, I think that's very true. And the thing about buying on eBay is, I know that they have changed this, but, you know, it used to be that the dealers could rate the buyer after the buyer rated the dealer
exactly.
And everything. And
yeah.
I think they changed that.
They did.
Changed that. But still at the same time, how many people are willing, you know, when they buy a car or a lemon or anything, how many people are willing to put in that they got snookered on something?
Right.
So that's probably why there's, you know, no reflection on you, but I think your friend or whoever that was that told you that is absolutely correct.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, when I have had some involvement with eBay and was selling a lot on there for people and things like that, I would be, if someone flaked or did something wrong, I'd almost be afraid to give them bad feedback because I thought they would in turn give me bad feedback.
Right.
So there is always that, you know, so it is a really tough thing to monitor, and eBay can only get involved in so many aspects of what they do.
I don't buy and sell antiques, I just appraise, but when you talk about eBay and everything, it's not the only fish in the sea. All these wonderful auction houses, as you know probably better than I as an auctioneer, have everything on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy from those auction houses with, you know, call them up and say, is this really a French bronze by Moreau or Men and whatever? And, you know, you can buy with complete confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And did the person that bought your bronze, was it on the internet or somebody in the audience?
It was audience.
Audience. Well, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the real impact, because I know the serious collectors will buy from the auction houses and everything. It was like here in Cincinnati, some pals of mine that own the Wood Nickel Antiques, they had a painting a couple of years ago, I forget who the artist was, but from the late 1700s, a British dude, and they had a certain estimate on it, and it went way and above what they thought it would go for, and it sold to somebody in Australia.
Well, at Clarks, we're like I say, that I do contract work. There's in the back room. There's a world map with pins on it, and I'm telling you, when eBay was involved, especially, things go all over the globe. We had a modern speaker system, believe it or not, Danish modern, that Tony Curtis had one above his pool and stuff like that. It was a real rare one, Lansing. And it went for $15,000, and the thing weighed about 400 pounds, and it went to Korea.
Wow.
You know, so that's...
Good name job. Or how's Tom doing?
I don't know.
Huh?
I don't know. He's not a neighbor.
No, that's great. Yeah, you're right. That's great. What's big in California? Mid-century?
Yeah, mid-century modern, I would say. You know, it's kind of, for me, it's kind of tough growing up in New England and watching... auctions sometimes when you know, I bought a beautiful New Hampshire banister back chair, you know, just about 300-year-old chair for $12.50 at auction, and then you see a piece like mid-century modern, like there's a carver that was in the 1970s. Now, we're talking 1970s. We're not talking, you know, 50s.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Espinay. And we sold a flat headboard made of walnut, very simple, very plain, nothing desirable looking about it, for $12,000.
Yeah, oh, in one of my books, I think it was Secrets to Affordable Antiques, I wrote, the chairs are the biggest bargain in the world of antiques. Do you agree?
Oh, always. Yeah, because they're so plentiful, for one. You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a great buying a banister chair for $12. That's wonderful. And the other thing is, though, that banister chair, you're like me. I just like looking at them. They're not terribly comfortable.
No, that's why they lasted so long.
Right. And I think that's great. And the other thing I wrote in Secrets to Affordable Antiques is that if you want to get more for your money, or I like to say more antique dash for your cash, always buy what isn't popular. And, you know, mid-century is the big thing.
Now, I did an interview with a guy that is a mid-century modern dealer, but he was doing it all the way back into the late 1970s when nobody wanted it. He was buying Eames chairs for $10, you know.
So he was the Lillian Nassau of mid-century then.
Yep. I mean, he did it with Art Deco, too, even before that. He started out when he was 17 years old.
Good for him.
Yeah. And, hey, so you just mentioned a book. Why don't you talk? You have three books, right? And you're working on another?
Yes, I have three books. The first one was called Is It Antique Yet? Second book is, God, you'd think I could remember these, couldn't you? Secrets to Affordable Antiques. And the third book is called Antiques 101.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm working on one now that I got to get one more chapter finished, called The First Ladies of Antiques.
Uh-huh.
No, that's not the name of it. The Grand Dames of Art and Antiques.
Oh, that sounds better.
Grand Dames, yes.
Now, on my website, I did put an Amazon link to at least one of your books on my books, recommended books page that I have
there. Well, thank you, Martin.
Sure. And make a great Christmas gift, right? Because it's still time.
Yeah, well, listen, since we're talking about Christmas gifts and that you grew up in New England, and I wanted to bring up something about Christmas that I'm still in therapy about, and we're talking about mid-century. What is, this question for Martin, what is, at Christmas time, the definitive example of mid-century? It's something to do with Christmas.
Ooh, jeez, that is...
It's not tricky, but you want me to tell you, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. But
because I have absolutely...
Aluminum Christmas trees!
You got to be kidding me.
With those, you know, lights that go... I hate them. I hated them back then, I hate them now. And I have met more people that, in my age group... that remember those from childhood, and they feel the same way. So, you know,
I agree. I remember my grandmother had one year, and everyone shamed her in it. You know, she never put it up again.
Well, that was lucky. Your grandmother was smarter. My mother had them up. You know, we had. Oh my God, I hated those things. But those are, you know, when somebody who's 25 years old, they think those are really cool. You know, the aluminum, and I think they're wonderful because I'm so glad. I think think people that collect mid-century are the younger people. Well, some people middle-aged, but younger people. And I think that's wonderful, but it, because the definition of antique, Martin, keeps expanding all the time. Don't you agree?
I do. And I heard what you said on your the show when people were questioning about, you know, the age, what makes it an antique. And you use the insurance standard of 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think isn't it longer in England for their insurance standard? I've heard that it's like 150 years.
Well, it probably is pre-industrial revolution. You're right. And of course, I love how the French do it. As you probably know, when they say antiquité for antiques, they mean 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
anything, and then they have that word brocante, B-R-O-C-A-N-T-E-S. Meaning, you know, anything from the 19th century onwards and things like that. And I think that that's a great definition. But, you know, I don't really, anyway, you know, I'm at the stage and I'm telling you, don't even worry. It's the quality that matters. And don't, you know, worry about antique or whatever.
Yes.
And the insurance people like to call it a fine art.
Mm-hmm.
And back to that mid-century, mm-hmm. I'm delighted that the young people are collecting that because it keeps the antiques popular and everything, and I hope, like, my nephew is 32, and since the day Ryan was born, Uncle Frank has tried to make him an antiquer. And Uncle Frank has succeeded, and he's into mid-century. I just hope as these collectors grow and mature and learn more, that they might focus on previous, you know, 1900 or 1800s or the 1700s.
Right. Now, you just brought up a good point and something that I have thought quite a bit about, and that is, it's not like there's it's almost rare when you see a young person bidding at an auction on an antique.
Well, our minds have been crossing. I wanted to bring that up earlier. So you think it's rare then?
Yes, I do. I think, and I had this discussion with a bunch of auctioneers at a convention, 15 years ago, like they're saying, have you noticed there's not as many young people getting into antiques as there used to be?
Mm-hmm.
And in my day in the 70s, when I was, you know, a teen, I knew other people my age that were into it, but I don't see a lot of that anymore.
Well, I think that's a very good observation, and of course, you know, dealers, you know, are saying antique shows are dying and everything, but I think a couple of observations is that the auctioneers and stuff that are saying that may be talking about 18th century, 19th century, early
sure.
20th century items, you know, not 1970s or 1980s, but I think that the young collectors are going back and collecting Elvis Presley on velvet, which, you know, the king of retro from the 1980s and stuff like that. So I think that they are, but they're not focusing on earlier things. And then the dealers and stuff forget who the heck has money anymore these days for $25,000 this or that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's always been a small portion of people that would go for that type of thing, for sure.
Right.
But antiques, like you've heard you say in your show before, it can be a great deal. I mean,
right. Well, and the other thing about, you know, that $25,000 item is far more proportionately more money now than it was back 30 years ago. Maybe 30 years ago, when people had more of a purchasing power and everything, it might have been $1,000 or $2,000.
You know, just to bring a point back in the 1978 or so, I worked for a guy I'm going to be podcasting later on, who had a retail shop and an auction hall, both.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that there was a set of 6 double press back chairs, and I was working the floor that day, and a guy came in and laid down $4,000 for that set.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and you think about, okay, retail is one thing and all that, but oak was so hot at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you took that, $4,000, now I did a little bit of math the other day, just figuring out what this future podcast is going to do. That equals $11,000 today or so. And then if you went to sell them those same exact chairs, if they were in good condition, it'd be about $200 to $400 today.
Yeah. Now you're talking about their oak stain press back ones.
Right. With the cane seat.
1910-ish?
Sure. Yes.
And how many were there?
There was a set of 6.
6, you said. Okay. 2 armchairs?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Well, you know, I think 4,000, can I be honest with you?
Yeah, it was a high price.
It got snookered at $4,000.
Yeah, but you know what? That shop was very busy.
Well, you know, but that's just like what we said, you know, I said earlier, don't buy what's fashionable.
Exactly.
And I agree with you that, you know, that the market for 1900 oak is very, very soft these days. But, you know, and also things just sort of price them out of the, you know, the market. Like, to me, a brass bed from the 1970s might have been about $500.
Yeah.
And that's what they sell for today, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yes.
And so things do price themselves out of the market. And I think another couple examples, and you can tell me if you agree with me, are roll top desks.
Oh, yes, exactly.
And blue willow, you know, willow china in the blue and white pattern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, things just price themselves out of the market. And then you're right, because things, you know, oak, that was mass-produced Sears and Roebuck quality when it was new. And I think you're literally
in the Sears and Roebuck book.
Literally, yeah, which is a great way. I love always telling my students when I teach at the University of Cincinnati to always look in the reproduction catalogs of Sears and Montgomery Ward. It's a great learning device.
Sure, sure. And they were like $12 or something like that.
Yeah,
that was
right.
Cool.
But that poor guy, you're right about those chairs.
Yeah, well, the...
if he paid $4,000 for a set of six English or, let's say, American Chippendale chairs, which... could have been a realistic price back then.
Sure.
Think what those would be worth today.
Yep, and along those lines, you know, it is a very trendy, it really involves with what the trend is. And it has, you know, I've talked to an old-time dealer that his family was in the business since before the Depression, and he said it's always been about trends, but one thing he says he's never seen in his, you know, his family had never seen since the Depression was such good buys and good American furniture.
As right now?
Yes.
That's what, you know, that's what I'm telling clients, you know, if they want to consign something or something, I'm always telling them, you know, hold off and wait because the market's so soft now. And I said, you know, the auctioneers, they only want the best of the best because that's the thing that's bringing good money. And I said, you know, you can't blame them. They're trying to make a living and everything. So I basically am telling people to hold off on sending something to auction.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard for me to do because I'm in the auction business.
Right, right. So don't hate me.
It's okay. But there are exceptions. And I think I truly think because I go back and forth, my son's on the East Coast, and I go back and forth quite a bit. And I really, really think that California prices are a little bit more stable than other parts of the country.
Good.
You know, because here's an example. I was at an auction 3 weeks ago, and the furniture was what they call brown furniture. Even was flying. It was going above estimate over and over and over again.
So you mean like English Chippendale and things like Hemelite and things like that?
Well, there was like a Spanish Baroque table, and it was.
Oh, and they were going for big bucks.
That one went for $10,000.
That's very interesting. And Spanish Baroque furniture is—I never heard Spanish Baroque called brown furniture before, but it is brown.
I meant the when I was saying that, I meant the other things that you know, like mahogany and stuff like that.
I was thinking you were using that expression. In the Midwest, they always say people like brownie antiques, meaning English boring antiques. You know, and they don't want anything French, God forbid. Well, you know, was that auction in California?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, I would think that $10,000, that was a great place to sell that because I don't think, you know, maybe in the Midwest or the East Coast, Spanish Baroque would bring nearly that much. But because California's heritage and, you know, settled by the Spanish and everything, I think that made more fanfare for it. Doesn't that make sense?
It does, totally. And it's, you know, there, like we're talking about a lot today, there's always exceptions, but you can get really, really good buys on period American furniture in California for the most part. Now, once
I bet it would go that would probably go better on
the East Coast. That's right. And out here, what is really strong is the Georgian, you know, the English, continental, and French furniture. You know, a really fine French piece will bring all the money out here.
That's great. I am glad to hear that because in Cincinnati, that isn't the case. Oh, it's French. And of course, in New Orleans, you know.
Yeah, French is down there. Sure, yeah.
We went to M. Rowley Antiques. I've interviewed Bill before on the show and everything, and we went in there. And my God, that was, there wasn't a piece of uncurlicue furniture in that whole place.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was two big auction houses in New Orleans. Oh, geez. Great Gatsby?
I'm trying to think. New Orleans Auction Gallery?
I'm talking about 10 years ago or so. They were really, really strong, and they were competing strongly against each other.
I think they're still there. I used them on my. Let me see if I can get the Oh my God! I know what you're talking about.
But they
it's not Eldred's. That's not it.
No, that's in.
There's in one called. It's going to come back to me. Well, here, you're going to an auction again. Anyway.
Well, that's okay. But anyway, what my point was is, they had some phenomenal ads, and they're just fabulous French furniture in that those auctions, like I had never seen anywhere, you know, in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Was coming up in out of New Orleans.
They love French furniture down there.
Yeah, and also that was really nice in that show you did about New Orleans. That was really interesting to hear that the museum was up above the water level.
Well, wasn't that just the greatest story? And how he, John, had told all the employees to come and bring their loved ones and bring their pets and everything.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
because you know there was that whole thing about how people weren't, you know, offered to escape and everything. I certainly can understand that. I wouldn't want to leave my two dearest friends in the whole world, Sally Ann and Dolly, to fend for themselves. I'd rather go with them than, you know, like a clown or something. And I certainly, and John has a greyhound that he rescued. So, you know, I know it sounds so trite of me to say, but that story just touched my heart.
Yeah. I mean, your pets are, you know, a lot of people consider them as less than, but, you know, I mean, there's no better devotion than a pet.
You must have a dog.
I do. I have a dog, yes.
What kind?
It's a Chihuahua.
This is so funny because I love how the Today Show is always trying to find homes for dogs, everything, and they said Chihuahua. Martin, you're so chic. That, according to the Today Show, that's the number one dog in California.
Is that right? Jeez, yeah.
That's what it ties in with the Spanish Baroque furniture.
I'm a trendsetter because I've had him for 5 years. So,
you are, yeah. Because, you know, we think it's, aren't Chihuahuas sort of associated with Mexico and everything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a great
one. So it just makes perfectly good sense. Wonderful Mexico and everything. But, yeah, I love that story, too. And, Tommy, do you remember, I think I said that in the interview, in 05, in the fall, right after Katrina, the Columbus Museum of Art, which is 2 hours north of Cincinnati, had this incredible exhibition of Renoir's.
Yes, and they had the empty frame there.
The empty frame that was supposed to come from New Orleans. And that exhibit about Renoir was, I'm looking at a copy of Renoir right now in my office here. Renoir is my most favorite artist of all time, and I like a lot of them. But anyway, then I went back in January, and New Orleans Museum of Art saw to it that painting got to the Columbus Museum of Art. That was the most incredible art exhibit. But I learned that museum people aren't so keen on Renoir because he's not intellectual, you know. They want paintings that have a message. They want you to look at blood and gore and have a message.
Yeah. One thing I always remember about Renoir when I first saw one in a museum when I was a kid was nobody paints eyes like Renoir did. You know?
You're right.
There's really something about those eyes.
Well, you know, you asked me about antiques and everything, how I got into it. I had the most wonderful grandmother in the world, and she would take me. She lived in Chicago, and I was born in Chicago, but I grew up nearby, and I'd visit her, and she would take me to the Art Institute of Chicago, one of the world's greatest museums, and the famous Renoir is there on the terrace. And that's how I fell in love with Renoir.
That's
the famous one. I don't know if it's a big sister or a mother with a little girl. And any Renoir takes my breath away. And I got to see a couple in New Orleans and a really unusual one at the Carnegie Museum of Art recently. So I was quite thrilled about that.
I think the On the Terrace, isn't it his most famous masterpiece?
Well, you know, I kind of thought that, but then, you know, I can't be objective, but I read there's a wonderful book if anybody wants to read it. It's called, just Google Renoir, or The Boating Party, and it's a novel, but it's based on fact, how he did The Boating Party and then previously had done the Moulin de la Galette, and according to that book, those two are the ones that put him on the map. And The Boating Party is at another wonderful museum in D.C., the Phillips. And they kind of alluded that those were his two most famous, but I agree with you. I always thought that On the Terrace was, you know, his most famous painting.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I want to bring up to our listeners, which is, and hope they'll listen to some of your shows, is the thing that you do when people call in, and I don't know if I could ever do this, and that is, I heard some guy call in one time, and he says, yeah, I got a chair, and it's got these squigglies on it, and then it had, you know, I mean, people are describing something to you, and somehow you figure, through detective work or something, you figure out exactly what they have. I think that's such a talent, because when I'm trying to screen people, say, for auction or whatever on the phone, I really go into detail about what they're trying to tell me they have if they don't have a way to get me pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you do it.
Well, I know, and they're probably their famous line to you. You know, I don't know how I do it. Thank you for the compliment. I don't, you know, I don't. But I imagine, yeah, you go through that all the time, and they say, well, there was one on the road show, and it was appraised for $50,000.
Yeah, that's, you just brought up something that's, I don't want to say it's a pet peeve, but what happens is when something really exciting comes up on the road show, we get calls, and it's, you know, as auctioneers, I remember, oh, I don't know, 15 years ago, some amazing sword was on the roadshow, and all of a sudden, everybody's in the auction gallery with swords, you know, it's like...
Oh, the Civil War one, yeah.
So everyone thinks all of a sudden they have the $10,000 or the $100,000
right.
piece, and, you know, the old saying, a little bit of knowledge is dangerous,
right.
And that kind of fits that.
Couldn't agree with you more about that. But, you know, they don't differentiate that the Chippendale side chair is 1780 and theirs is 1935.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, you're right about that. Right. That's funny. You know, the sword, I remember that. There was all kinds of controversy about that sword, too, wasn't there?
It seems to me that there was something about that.
Something fishy went on about that.
Yeah. But anyway, I think... I usually run these about 40 minutes, and we're just about there right now, Frank. And I've really, really enjoyed this.
So did I. Thank you, Martin.
And let's go quickly over how one more time on how people would find you.
They can go to keepantiquing.org.
Okay, and you have some type of saying you always say about antiques.
Oh, okay, everybody. I want you to always be chipper and to remember to keep antiquing.
There it goes. Okay. This is Martin Willis with Frank Farmer Loomis from Cincinnati. And we're signing off. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Martin.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Wait. Don't go away. I want to talk to you about how you can help us out. We love doing this show. We do it for free. However, we do have some expenses, and you can help us without even realizing you're doing it. And that is, if you're going to purchase something on Amazon, why not go to our website, www.antiqueauctionpodcast.com. Up in the right-hand corner, you'll see there's an Amazon search engine. You can search for your item there, and if you purchase it, we will receive a small fee. That'll help us carry on. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.